Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, talking to start the program about the history of surgery at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, UW-Madison. Our guests, we have two guests for you. One, Dr. Rebecca Minter with us. She's chair of the department and the first woman to hold that role. Dr. Minter's a leader in the field of surgery of the pancreas, the liver, and the gallbladder. Dr. Minter, welcome. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Larry. It's great to be here.
Great to have you with us. Dr. Michael Bentz with us as well. He is a professor in the Department of Surgery at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, and he's a pediatric plastic and reconstructive surgeon at UW Health. Dr. Bentz, thank you for joining in as well.
Thanks for having us, Larry.
As we talk with our two guests, we want to hear from you. Maybe you have some questions about surgery. What does it take to be a surgeon? Maybe how surgery has helped change your life. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Dr. Minter, I'll start with you. I understand the UW Department of Surgery is certainly one of the leading academic surgical programs in the nation. In your mind, what's behind the program's success?
Well, I came to UW in 2018, so I'm a relative newcomer compared to many of the people like Dr. Bentz and other colleagues who have been here for a long time. And I can tell you that I came here because of the people, and that's why I stay as well. I think that this department has really been built on the foundation of incredible talent, but also really collaborative thought leaders that have helped shape the discipline of surgery in both with respect to the clinical aspects of surgical care, but also in the field of research and bringing new innovation, new discovery, and really training what I believe are some of the most outstanding surgeons that leave here and go out into the world to take care of patients and spread really the brand of UW beyond our walls.
Somebody's already asking here, what is and isn't considered surgery?
That's a great question, because those lines have become blurred. And I think that, you know, within our department, we have 11 divisions across 11 different specialties. And our surgeons also do what some would call procedures. We have surgeons now who are able to do things through scopes that we previously would have to cut people open for. We collaborate with colleagues in other departments who do invasive procedures. And really, I think one of the things that makes UW great is we have tremendous partnership across departments and really try to get the best thing for a given patient and the least invasive and least harmful option for them.
You know what? Pam and Marshall's on board. And before I go to you, Dr. Bentz, let's go to Pam and Marshall. Pam, hi.
Hi, this is Pam, and I just wanted to first of all thank UW. 25 years ago, I had cancer of the uterus, and the health insurance company that I had didn't have anybody that could operate on a 422-pound woman, and UW had a plastic surgeon there that helped with that, and he did a fantastic job, and I was treated with utmost kindness and respect, and I've never forgotten that.
Oh, Pam, thank you so much for calling. Dr. Bentz?
Well, Pam,
well, you're both smiling, by the way. So.
Well, Pam, first I would say thank you for calling. I'm not surprised our leadership and surgeons at that time worked to deliver a high level of clinical care like we do today. And I would say that 25 years later, I hope our patients now feel the same thing about their care, which is more commonly multidisciplinary. And I think that reflects the first question about what surgery or not. We have worked in much more collaborative fashion, particularly at our health system, to deliver solutions working with other disciplines that are best for the patient with high efficacy, high safety, and best outcomes. And I think that's very different in medicine now, perhaps, than 30 years ago or 40 years ago, where a lot of medicine and surgery happened in silos. Now across health systems, people are working together for kind of novel, creative, and highly successful solutions to challenging problems.
Yeah. Pam, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. And you could join in too at 800-642-1234. Well, it's the 100th anniversary, and that means the department's been around since 1924. Can you give us a picture of what the department was like in 1924?
Well, we can share what we know. Neither Dr. Benson nor I were here in 1924. You know, 1924 was really when the School of Medicine transitioned from being a two-year medical school to a four-year medical school. And at that time, they created two departments, two clinical departments, the Department of Medicine and the Department of Surgery. And so at that time, it was all things surgery, including things like neurosurgery, orthopedics, urology, all the disciplines of surgery. And there were only three faculty, three full-time faculty who were paid $8,000 a year. So looked very different. They took care of patients in the community and also trained residents. And really, I would say education was the primary focus at that time. But even in the early days, the early seeds of research and innovation began to take hold. So Wisconsin General Hospital was the hospital that was then built that they practiced in. And then, you know, 45 years ago or 55 years ago, we moved to the hospital facility that we're in today. So it looks a lot different now with 170 surgeons just in the Department of Surgery and six surgical departments. So a lot has changed.
How have medical surgical ethics changed over time? You're probably still holding to some, you know, basic tenets that have been around forever, but how have things changed?
Well, I think, and Dr. Benz can comment as well, I think that the things that haven't changed, importantly, is that the patient is always at the center of what we do, whether that is caring for their condition, their disease, their trauma, or training the next generation or research. It always comes back to the patient. And in surgery, I think it's in all of medicine, but I think it really comes home in surgery of, you know, first do no harm. So I think that has not changed, and that's always at the heart of what we do. I think what's changed in medicine more broadly, and what we are actually a leader in the world, really through work that some of our surgeons have led, Dr. Schwarzy and others, is that medicine overall has become less paternalistic. You know, it used to be we would tell you what needed to be done, and then that would be the end of the conversation. That is no longer appropriate or the way that we practice. So it's really around shared decision-making, understanding what a patient's given goals are and what's most important to them, and then making sure that whatever treatment we offer hopefully helps them achieve those goals. And that's really different over the last 100 years, for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, that's got a huge change. Tom in Minocqua has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Larry. First of all, thanks to these doctors and all doctors who offer care. It's becoming harder and harder to find doctors, and so we're ever more grateful for what they do and their commitment to this. My question has to do with medical students. At what stage in their journey through medical school did they decide to specialize in surgery, and how do you begin to learn how to perform surgery, because there isn't much of a margin for error in surgery, I would think.
So where in the process of med school does someone choose to study surgery? And then how does the person learn? I think was what Tom from Minocqua was asking.
So it can be a complex evolution to the decision to be a surgeon, or for some people, it's intuitive and they know all along what they want to do. In general, the first several years of medical school or general medical education interspersed with some clinical experience, so you begin to see what the possibilities are in a health science career in medicine. the third year of medical school into the fourth year, very specific clinical rotations where the students rotate with the various services across the medical school, which at this point is 17 different departments. And then into their last year of medical school, they refine their choices and then enter a match process where they determine where they're going to train in whatever their selected residency is. In the kind of previous, most common previous model, people would complete a primary residency, commonly in general surgery, and then move on to 2 or 3 year residencies in a subspecialty before doing a year of fellowship training in a very specific area and then enter practice. Now, many subspecialties will match students for an extended residency right out of medical school for 6, 7, or even 8 years so they can focus on this one area, given the large amount of material there is to learn. People still add on fellowship training for a year or two, or even research for those academically inclined. And so the training after medical school can be 10 years in a non-extreme circumstance. So many surgeons don't have their first job till they're 35 years old. And they've been in training that length of time to hone their skills and learn their craft.
Yeah. I was thinking as you were talking, I said, I wonder how soon they're ready for retirement by the time they're finished with the. But I imagine that that education never quits.
It's lifelong. There's no doubt about it. And we always tell our trainees the scariest year of all of your training is the first year in practice when suddenly the buck stops with you.
Oh, well, I wanted to spend a bit of time talking about some of the achievements. You know, I was reading up a bit on, and, you know, sort of some jaw-dropping things that have been developed within surgery here. I think one of the world's first anesthesiology units was established at UW. It'd be interesting. Talk a bit about the history of anesthesiology as it pertains to surgery.
It is a great, it's a great question. And I would say I will be sharing what I know from reading about that history, because anesthesiology, it is one of the oldest anesthesiology departments in the country, if not perhaps the first, and was initially in surgery, but split out long ago, has been a separate freestanding department for a long time. Interestingly, though, I am the first woman to be the chair of the department, and we have almost 50% of our faculty are women now, which is very, very unusual across the country. That was not always the case, and there was actually a young student who had wanted to be a surgeon but wasn't a very welcoming field in her day, named Virginia Apgar, who came here instead to become an anesthesiologist. And those of you who have had children will know the Apgar score when a baby is born. And so that's part of our history as well, of really a rich history of early innovation and development of the field of anesthesiology here at UW.
You know, one of the scariest moments of my early childhood, this is a little different area here, when I was just a little kid, my aunt took me to a hospital to visit a friend who was in an iron lung with tuberculosis. And that's something I can still picture that. I couldn't have been more than about 5 or 6 years old. But there's, I know that surgeons at the UW have helped out in that whole field of tuberculosis.
So that is, thankfully, at least in this country, pretty much managed. And tuberculosis is rare, except for dense urban situations. We do encounter tuberculosis in our global health work in developing countries around the world. But those advances from general anesthesia away from ether, safety went up to current techniques in regional anesthesia, where many operations, including hip replacements, knee replacements, can be done with a regional anesthesia, injection and sedation without taking the risk of putting someone to sleep, have increased the efficacy, decreased the cost, and improved the outcomes of the surgical procedures that we do. And then with the extension of that, the ability not only from anesthesia, but to support the circulatory system and circulation with bypass pumps for cardiac surgery, but probably more frequently and importantly to some degree for ill patients is ECMO, which is extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, which is a way to support pulmonary function, which is a reason why a lot of people survived the COVID crisis, because we could support their oxygenation with our ECMO teams that are hybrids of surgery and anesthesia teams for improving patient survival.
Our two guests today, Dr. Michael Benson, Dr. Rebecca Minter, surgeons at the UW Department of Surgery within the UW Medical School. It's great to have them with us today. If you have questions, I hope you'll join in. The number is 800-642-1234. You could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Two guests for you today, Dr. Rebecca Minter, professor and chair of the Department of Surgery at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. She's a pancreatic obi-biliary, which is a really hard word to pronounce, and a surgeon in that area, a surgical education researcher and a surgical oncologist at UW Health. Dr. Michael Benz, professor in the Department of Surgery and a pediatric plastic and reconstructive surgeon at UW Health. And I hope you'll join in, give a call. Lots of people online already, but there's a line open for you at 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. And we're kind of celebrating here, in my mind, I hope in yours as well, the 100th anniversary of the Department of Surgery at the UW-Madison, and taking a look at some of the many achievements from that department. And it's a pleasure for me to talk with him. Dave is on Highway 10 in the car, I'm betting. Dave, hi.
Hello, how are you?
Great, appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm a retired anesthesiologist. I tell my friends I'm still on the waiting list at UW Medical School. I went to Medical College of Wisconsin.
Okay.
I'm a retired cardiac anesthetist. My question for you is, the recent ruling that came down on one of the Medicare Advantage plans was to limit reimbursement for anesthesia based on the length of time of the procedure. And I have had 45 years of experience knowing what it's like, that some surgeons are quick and efficient, others are quick and maybe not so good, and others are slow as heck. Is this going to domino in terms of billing issues? Because it's going to create a balanced bill problem for a patient if the insurance company only pays for a specific time. And, of course, we can't just turn the juice off in the middle of the case. So I'm curious about your opinion. I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Thank you very much for calling.
So obviously it's a very timely topic amidst what's happening with the tragedy of the CEO of United Healthcare being murdered. This was a topic that has just recently come up. It was with the Anthem product and out of New York. And fortunately that has been quickly walked back. You're exactly right. They say, you know, whenever you ask a surgeon how long the case is going to take, double it, because we're always very optimistic about how quickly we will operate. And it's ridiculous, of course, that you would not support a patient's entire anesthesia bill for the procedure. So it's my understanding that fortunately it's been walked back, but I think it's just a symptom of the broader issue we're seeing in our country, where we have increased denials and increased just layers of bureaucracy that we have to walk through to try to get the care our patients need. And our payers are, of course, also trying to take care of their patients and do the best that they can for them. But it does seem like it's a process that needs an overhaul all the way around to make it easier and cost effective for patients to get the right care.
Yeah. Sean in Mineral Point has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Sean.
Hi, how are you guys today?
Great. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, I was driving in to work today, and I'm only doing that because Dr. Bentz was one of the surgeons that was able to help get me back into health and able to do it. And I'm driving and I hear his voice, and, you know, I was just reminded at how much hard work he and the entire UW system put in with me. I can only imagine what they've done for so many other people, and I'm truly grateful to him and the entire system.
Sean, thank you for calling. Dr. Bentz, I hope you get to hear that once in a while, more often.
Well, Sean, thank you. I'm glad you're well. Most importantly, I'm glad we were able to deliver what you needed, both as a surgeon, but more importantly, as a health system, which is really the delivery of healthcare now is through systems. Back to the original question, I would say this anesthesia comment is one that should urge patients and physicians of all types to learn to become advocates for appropriate health care with insurers, with the government. I think that, the 30, 40, 50 years ago where care was delivered and there was not the same check and balance system, I think now we're in a different era. And, you know, for Sean to get the care that he needs and other patients, it's going to require both patients and physicians working together as advocates for their care, for their appropriate care, using data to deliver care in the most cost-efficient fashion possible. We know there are plenty of opportunities in our health system to do that, but having worked in developing countries my entire career, this is an excellent health system. We just need to make it more efficient, and I think that'll take us all working together.
Yeah, for sure. I want to take a look at a couple of other achievements as we move along here today before we go back to the phones. One that comes to mind is the care in cancer treatments. And there's something called Mohs surgery that I think is practiced in a heck of a lot of places. And maybe Dr. Minner or
I'm going to give this one to Dr. Bentz.
Dr. Bentz, go.
UW surgery and our other colleagues in other departments have had significant impact over time on the care of cancer. One area that is international in nature is Mohs surgery. Dr. Fred Mohs initiated the concept of Mohs surgery, which is a way of removing skin cancer with a particular way to look at the specimen that's removed so that there's a high likelihood that the cancer is removed and the recurrence rates are less. It has, like most things in medicine, specific indications and things, but it is now used around the world for skin cancer treatment as a part of Dr. Mohs's efforts here. It's interesting, when I first came here in 1999 and started learning about Dr. Mohs, when he started this concept of Mohs surgery, which, like much of medicine, evolved, he was felt to be a charlatan in the House of Medicine, working in our department, but he had a vision and an idea and passion and continued to refine this procedure, which is now the gold standard for skin cancer removal, literally around the world. So that's one of the many impacts of our department and our institution on healthcare globally.
There was a lot of research, or has been a lot of research in your department on chemotherapeutic treatments for cancer as well. Has there not? Dr. Minner, maybe you can comment on that.
Sure. I know less about predecessors in terms, there has been a lot of oncologic research done in terms of developing various therapies. Dr. Bentz may know more in terms of the specifics, which predated my arrival here. And those individuals now also are in multiple other departments as well. I don't know, Mike, if you want to.
I would say very high level. You know, primary care cancer and secondary care cancer has been impacted by UW efforts. 5-FU as a therapy, which is used as a cancer chemotherapy therapeutic agent, was developed here. Many patients who have cancer are prone to clotting in the vessels in their body. Warfarin, which is an anticoagulant, which is developed here, has impacted people around the globe. Most people are surprised to know that Warfarin stands for Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation, which provided the funding, and that has had impact. Moving off of cancer to transplant, Dr. Folker Belzer, the chair of surgery in the 80s and the 90s, working with his lab PhD and colleague, Dr. Jim Southard, developed University of Wisconsin solution, UW solution, otherwise known as Belzer solution, which is used in solid organ transplantation like liver and kidney to preserve the length of time that the organ can be usable. And that is still today the most common and the most prominently used transplant solution in transplant services and institutions literally around the globe. A huge international impact for the transplant patient.
Well, yeah, and as I'm remembering this, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think originally you had to do the transplant in within about 6 hours.
Mm-hmm. And that's correct, yeah. And the ability with the UW solution, which is what it's called around the world and still used today, extended the ability to preserve an organ for up to 20 hours. And Dr. Belzer actually flew to Europe to demonstrate that an organ could be preserved on a transatlantic flight and then implanted and function. And he had to win Tom Starzl over, because nobody in the field, going back to Dr. Benz's comments about Dr. Mohs, nobody believed that this could be possible. And Dr. Starzl at the time, who was at the University of Pittsburgh, was really an icon in transplant surgery, had to really become an advocate for this. So Dr. Belzer went to Pittsburgh and convinced Dr. Starzl, and really this is still the approach today for preserving organs around the world.
Pretty cool, and it's still called UW Solution, too.
It is.
I like that. John sent us an email. Ask your guests about the award recently given to Dr. Bing Rickers in San Francisco regarding the department's outstanding history.
Absolutely. I'd love to talk about that. So Dr. Rickers is one of my predecessors, and who really is incredibly beloved, and I think really following, you know, Dr. Belzer really put the University of Wisconsin Department of Surgery on the map in terms of really recruiting people from all over, building out all of the specialty areas in the department. Obviously, Dr. Belzer had tremendous impact as well, but huge focus on transplant. Dr. Rickers really built out the department. He recruited Dr. Benz as one great example of the individuals that he recruited, and still is quite involved and engaged with the department. He was recently recognized by the American College of Surgeons with their highest award, the Distinguished Service Award, and we were fortunate to all celebrate with him and his family there in San Francisco. And this is really in recognition not only of his contributions here at Wisconsin, but also, you know, nationally in the field of surgery, where he's had tremendous impact.
That's pretty cool. Really cool. Dr. Rebecca Minter and Dr. Michael Benz, our guests today from the Department of Surgery at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, celebrating 100 years this year of service to Wisconsin, and as kind of learning today, not only Wisconsin, but pretty much around the world. And I hope you'll join in with your questions or comments. What do you want to know about the surgery process, or maybe you've got a comment to share on the department? I hope you'll join in. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. Dr. Benz, when was the pediatric surgery program established?
So that's a great Madison success story. Pediatric surgical care and pediatric medical care has been delivered here in Madison for decades and decades. In the late 90s, moving into the early 2000s, there was a dream that a freestanding children's hospital could be built in Madison, then not requiring children, requiring high-level care being transferred over, driving to Milwaukee. Then UW Hospital CEO Donna Sullenberger committed to that dream, was able to work through the health system, the university, the legislature, the community, in working with very generous donors to pull together what is now our incredibly beautiful and high-level American Family Children's Hospital, which opened in 2007. Before that, care was provided within the adult hospital, and care was good, but the space was not pediatric friendly, nor were we in any position to absorb the capacity growth that we saw when the doors opened. And it is an absolute build it and they will come storyline, where we have grown from standard surgical care across the subspecialties. We've recruited subspecialists to grow these out. And we've gone from what I would say basic surgical care of children to full transplantation, viscera, liver, bowel, and most recently started a pediatric cardiac transplant program that would have been unthinkable without a building and the recruitment that Drs. Rickers, Dr. Kent, and Dr. Minter have done to establish these very high-level programs, which also includes fetal surgery. So this has benefited the children from Madison, the children in the region, the children in the Midwest, and a group of children that come from a distance to get highly specialized care. So it's been a great story that could not have happened with each of those groups working together, particularly our highly generous donors who made this expensive proposition possible. The success can be measured by the care outcomes, by the number of children seen. And not too long after it opened, we had to add a couple additional stories on top to expand our capacity, but stay within the FAA guidelines for our helicopter transport limitations. And again, that went back to donors, the community, and the group of administration here with a vision to continue to expand at a high level the care of children in the upper Midwest, but particularly for our Madison children who deserved this level of care and access, as did their parents.
Yeah. And the one of the things I note on that particular building is how inviting it is. And I've got to think that that has an impact on moms and dads and their children when they come.
If you haven't been in the lobby, it's beautifully designed to take some of the anxiety out of children and parents. And so that's nice on the surface, but really what counts is the level and the type of care delivered upstairs. The way the rooms have been designed that every parent can stay with their kid every night comfortably in a large room as part of their kind of journey of care. So there are multiple levels, both I would say on the side of design, but also more importantly on the side of function to continue to deliver this care.
I would just add as well that, you know, the Child Life program is outstanding and also has been heavily funded by really generous donors, to whether it's to the bringing the dogs in to see the kids and allowing them pet therapy and all sorts of things that really make it feel less scary for them.
Yeah. Holly in Abram, we'll go to you. Hi, Holly.
Hi, I do want to add to what I told your screener. The American Family Children's Hospital is a wonderful place for grandparents, too. Mm-hmm. My grandson had a surgery to repair a coarctation of his aorta at 5 days, and that he will be 12 in December. So we're very grateful for the care that he received in what was then, I think, a new program in 2012.
Thank you.
Yes, it was a wonderful experience, and the atrium there, or the lobby, is gorgeous. And my grandson had I have a three-year-old granddaughter, and so she would come, and she had her fourth birthday while my grandson was in the hospital, and the staff there helped us celebrate that fourth birthday for Scarlett. So it was a wonderful experience all around.
And you had a question relating to pancreatic cancer, if I'm not mistaken.
I did. I just wanted to ask Dr. Minter, and I understand there's a program on this that I will listen to, but what pancreatic cancer seems to happen, and it's always very late stage. Is there any screening that's being done before that people could participate in before the cancer gets that far? And I'll hang up and listen off the air. Thank you.
Thanks, Holly.
Well, I could talk about a whole hour just on this topic, but I will try to be brief. Yes, absolutely. We have a very unique and novel program here at UW. It's a program we started when I came in 2018. It opened in 2020, right as the pandemic hit. And it is for patients who have increased risk for pancreatic cancer. Population-based screening, as we do for, say, prostate cancer or breast cancer, hasn't worked for pancreatic cancer because even though it's on the rise, it's just not common enough, and we don't have a great test for it. However, patients who have incidental findings on their imaging that say they had appendicitis and we get some pictures of their pancreas, those patients get pulled in, we screen them. Patients who have a family history, we actively screen, and we're developing some really exciting new blood-based tests through Dr. Mohammed Murtaza, who leads our Center for Precision Medicine here at UW, and as a Department of Surgery faculty member, has developed some really exciting new tests that we hope will allow us to have better screening. But the UW Health Pancreatic Cancer Prevention Program is available for patients who have a family history or any increased risk for pancreatic cancer.
Thank you very much for that question. Susanna in Madison has a question as well. So let's go there. Hi, Susanna.
Hi, how are you?
Good, appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, I have had a number of surgeries at UW, and I have to say that I've been 90% pleased. I mean, every time that I've had orthopedic surgery or I had Mohs surgery, it was wonderful. But there was one time that I had a small hernia surgery, and of course they tell you all the things that could possibly happen. And a week later, I ended up with a terrible, terrible obstruction in my intestine. And we had actually gone to visit in Minneapolis and ended up being up there. I was in the hospital for over a week and had to stay another week till I could travel. And when I came back and went in to talk about it, I did not get a very positive reception. I was told, well, it rarely happens, and, you know, it's just how it is. My question is, how do you teach surgeons to really be sensitive to those kinds of things? Because I didn't want to make an issue about it, but it was concerning.
Okay. Thank you very much, Susanna, for calling. Well, I could probably have both of you comment one way or another. Dr. Benson, let's start with you.
Well, thank you for your call and appreciate your comments. As we, like every other organization, continues to work towards quality improvement, and we want every patient to have a perfect outcome and to feel like they're well-treated. When we don't entirely deliver, it's really helpful for us to know, because that helps with our processes. In terms of individual surgeons are not just technical machines, but they're also physicians. And we work at educating around that the hybrid of an excellent technician, but a really dedicated, patient-focused doctor is really the ideal hybrid of the care we want to deliver. So I do thank you for your comments because that helps us get better as we really think about ways we can continue to work to do better when we don't meet a goal.
Yeah, Dr. Minter, comment?
Sure. I would just add, I agree with everything that Dr. Bentz said, and we always want to know that, and we have processes to hear from patients, and we always try to respond. I think perhaps the other thing I would just share is to just know that as a surgeon, there's nothing more devastating than to have a patient not have the outcome that you hoped they would have. And unfortunately, we do sometimes have complications, and how people process that and handle that and communicate that is just as it is for all things related to being human. People have different ways they respond to that, and some are not always as empathetic as we would hope because they're sort of dealing with their own emotions around that complication. And so I'm sorry that that experience was not as we would hope it would be. But I would just share that as a surgeon, we also definitely feel terrible when things don't go as we hoped that they would.
Dr. Michael Bentz and Dr. Rebecca Minter, our guests from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, as we celebrate and talk about the 100th anniversary of the department. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at the health history of surgery with our two guests today, Dr. Michael Bentz and Dr. Rebecca Minter from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, as the department celebrates 100 years of service to the U.S. And the UW, and of course the world as well. And speaking of that, Ralph and Hayward emailed us. We should celebrate the incredible talent and innovation at UW Surgery. Wonders, do either of you have a healthcare model from around the globe of how incredible surgical talent and ideas are being expressed as compared to our system?
So I'll comment and then I'll turn over to Dr. Bentz. We actually, within our department, we are one of the national leaders in the space of global surgery. Dr. Girma Tafera, who is one of our faculty members, actually leads what's called the American College of Surgeons HOPE program, which is really focused on global surgery and sustainability and developing bidirectional relationships with other parts of the world around surgical care delivery. So I think we always have a lot to learn bidirectionally. And I'm going to turn things over to Dr. Bentz, who's deeply involved in global surgery and has been for most of his career.
Yeah. Dr. Bentz?
Ralph, thank you for that question. Our department is recognized nationally, internationally for a commitment to global surgery. If you look back 30, 40 years, global surgery was a bunch of well-meaning surgeons traveling to a developing country, operating on a bunch of kids or adults without a system around, come home, no idea really what happened with those kids or adults afterwards. And now we've morphed into delivery of care, including preoperative, intraoperative, and postoperative care. Our department has programs in Africa, Central America, South America, and Asia, where we are working towards capacity building. And that's the key part. These are longitudinal relationships, not trips where you parachute in, do a bunch of surgery and leave, but these are helping establish local systems in developing countries for the care of their children and adults. The foundation of that is the education of local surgeons. I have never operated in any of those places and not met surgeons who are really talented, motivated, who actually had enough hospital structure around them, but needed some confidence and perhaps some help with system building. What we're doing is working on capacity building. We don't need to be there year round, although that's a nice model, but it's somewhat impractical, where if we can help boost education both locally in country, but also through regular, you know, online video based education, we can increase the amount of cases that are done in country when we're perhaps not there in all of our disciplines where we participate in this. The flip side is that we learn how to deliver care in a lower cost system, and you learn a lot about how to save materials, how not to waste, how to deliver care at a lower cost with less capital support, less instruments, less kind of the things that we get accustomed to and comfortable here, don't necessarily add value and add cost. So as we all look at trying to decrease the cost of medicine, the experience of residents, fellows, medical students, and attending surgeons donating their time, that they're volunteering their time, not getting paid for this, to deliver education turns out to be a win-win in both direction in these longitudinal partnerships, which inevitably evolve into longitudinal friendships.
And I would just add one thing, which is that when we were in the throes of the pandemic and we had all of these supply chain issues, it was our Dr. Tefera, Dr. Bentz, our global surgeons who helped us think about how we could create the resources we need to take care of patients, because we were in a low resource setting at that point during the pandemic.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, this whole business of education, and just back here, is, you know, this is obviously educating those surgeons. That's a teaching place. And how's it evolved, or what are you doing now that maybe you didn't do before, Dr. Minner?
So surgical education is my sort of area of scholarship focus. And I remember vividly being a medical student, watching these residents operate with the attendings and thinking, how in the world, you know, in only 5 years will I be able to put that patient back together who suffered from a gunshot wound or something else? And I will just tell you that it's an amazing process, and the process works. I will say that we're really focused on innovation. It is that, as Dr. Bentz alluded to earlier, there's so much more to learn now, so many more technologies. You asked about what surgery, it is blurry. We do things with scopes and robots, and it's a lot more complicated, and the medical side of what we need to learn is much more complicated. So really our focus now is on how do we make sure that the product that we turn out stays as excellent as it has always been, but also prepares our surgeons for all the things that they need to know and doesn't make training 20 years instead of 10.
Yeah.
It's already too long. So we've really focused, and UW is a national leader, really leading the way in a new initiative that the American Board of Surgery is moving forward, which is really a focus. And this will sound silly because, of course, we've always worried about competency-based training, but really a focus away from time-based training to really being intentional around making sure that our graduates have all the skills they need to go into the world to continue to learn, as you highlighted. It's a continuous process. And so UW is a leader in that space of developing these new frameworks for training surgeons to make sure that they have the skills they need when they enter practice.
Yeah. Well, we got an email from Jim, and Jim has worked with both of you as a volunteer for a charitable organization. And his observation is, you will never find two more intelligent and kind individuals as these two professionals. And that's kind of a a nice way to end. And I want to thank you both for all your work over the years and for helping make the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health the great institution it is. It's been a pleasure for me to talk with you, and I hope we have a chance to talk again. Thank you both so much. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Larry. Thank you for the opportunity.
Dr. Michael Bentz, pediatric plastic and reconstructive surgeon at UW Health, and Dr. Rebecca Minter, pancreatobiliary, I got that almost right, surgeon, and a surgical education researcher and a surgical oncologist at UW Health. It's great to have an organization like this right here in our state of Wisconsin, and a pleasure for me to talk with them, and I hope you learned a little too along the way. And you're probably going to learn more about healthy sleep next. At least I could use a little more sleep and a little more healthy sleep myself, so I've got all kinds of questions for our next guest. I'm Larry Mietler.